Vegas, baby, Vegas!
At the end of the game, you count up your money. That's how you find out who's best.
All my bets were safe. There just wouldn't be any juice.
The point spreads, the prop bets, the teasers, the parlays. From Vegas to you, this is Behind the Bets.
Welcome in to the latest Behind the Bets podcast. I'm Doug Kazarian. It is Wednesday, February 27th, and that means March is just around the corner. So we're going to be talking college hoops coming up. Matt Eumanns of Vegas Stats and Information Network. And you know him from a lot of platforms out there if you are into sports betting. And Matt's been on the podcast before talking college football and college hoops a year ago. So we'll talk about some buying and selling as we head down the home stretch of the season. Also, some games tonight. He's got a couple plays. I have one as well. And then we'll look ahead to Saturday's card. He's circled some spots for this Saturday's card as well that you'll get ahead of as well, beat the market. And we'll also check in with Brett Okamoto, also in Las Vegas, ahead of this weekend's UFC card. He's got a couple plays, and we'll break down the huge favorite that John Jones is, minus 1,100. And I'm not going to say I'm a serial dater, but we have the third different producer here in the third straight week of the podcast. Troy, welcome in.
Thanks for having me, Doug. I'm sorry that we can't get any consistency for
you. Oh, I know. I'm teasing. Kai's on vacation. You know, all that money he won on the baby bankroll bonanza. He's got to spend it, so
I didn't know that.
I'm glad to be financing his vacations. It warms my heart that I could send everyone on a vacation.
What a giver you are.
So, Troy, how are you in the gambling space?
I know absolutely nothing about it. My friends are really big into it. I don't talk about it. I don't think about it at all. I gave up playing fantasy sports 2 years ago. The only gambling I do is Super Bowl squares.
Well,
bracket.
So, you know, we will touch. Hopefully you'll learn something on the podcast. We don't need you for your gambling expertise. We just need you for your producing and board operation expertise. So we have a lot of fun on the podcast. We'll do that with Matt and Brett. And, you know, we have Bob Lee weighing in from time to time.
On your mother's house or not. With my mother in it.
So Bob Lee weighs in with some drops. So you're new to the program.
What is that in reference to?
That is two for the money. Two for the money. They were asking the character, would you bet your mother's house on this bet? And he goes, I'd bet it with my mother in it.
Context is everything.
Yes. So Bob Lee is nice enough to voice a lot of drops for us. So coming up, we head out to Las Vegas for two interviews. And Matt Eumanns and also Brett Okamoto.
At gambling, the deadly sin is to mistake bad play for bad luck.
Now time to welcome in Matt Eumanns, friend of the program, if you will. I don't know what number it is on the program, Matt, so I wanted to name it, but I don't really have the number at the top of my head. But good to have you back here.
Well, I know John Murray's number one the program. He does a great job on the podcast. It's good to be back on. I don't think I've talked to you since college football season on this podcast.
Yeah, it makes sense. Obviously, you and I talk a lot. We saw each other out in Las Vegas when I did the Super Bowl piece, but it's good to connect here on the pod. I've always been a big fan of your college hoops knowledge in addition to other sports. And, you know, college hoops is tough to do on this podcast because the nature of this program is there's usually one a week in the off season of football. So obviously we'll do some picks tonight coming up, but there's also that, you know, sort of spots to look ahead to. And then with obviously championship week and the big dance around the corner, it's good to talk sort of macro concepts or just specifics, if you will. But let's get into teams, maybe like buy or sell kind of thing, peaking in on the decline. Like who stands out right now that could be some value either to fade or to back?
All right. Well, I'll tell you who I'm buying. And some people might scoff at this because the Pac-12 just has been a punching bag for critics this season. But I love the top team in the Pac-12. I think Washington is legit. And it's not going to surprise me a bit to see the Huskies in the Sweet 16. I think you got all the elements here for kind of a sleeper team. And, you know, it's hard to say the Pac-12 champ's going to be a sleeper team, but nobody respects the Pac-12 this year. And really nobody's talking about Washington, but this team is 22-5, 13-1 in the league play. And I think what's going to make Washington such a tough out in the tournament is the fact that Mike Hopkins, a longtime Jim Boeheim assistant, plays that 2-3 zone, Doug. And when you watch college hoops, so few few teams can run an effective offense against the zone. And that's why we see Syracuse make these runs occasionally when they have what are considered to be mediocre teams that slip in on the bubble. Mike Hopkins has a really talented team here in Seattle. Jalen Noel is the top scorer. He shoots 42.5% from three. He's a sophomore. You also have a low post horse in Noah Dickerson, who's 6'8", 250. He's a senior. Matisse Thybulle might be the best defensive player in the country. And that's, you know, a lot of people wouldn't even have an idea who he is unless you've watched Pac-12 pretty closely. But he gets 3.5 steals, 2.5 blocks a game, and he's a 6'5 guard, kind of the head of the snake for that defense. And I think Washington is a team that's going to do some damage. In Ken Palm's defensive efficiency rankings, Washington is number 12. I really think this zone makes us a dangerous team in March. I'll give you another team I'm buying. And I've been talking about this team for 2 months. And it finally slipped into the top 25 this week. So Wofford's cover has been blown. But Wofford's 24-4, 16-0 in the Southern Conference. And here's why I think this team is really dangerous. You know, when we see upsets in March, it's teams now that can just bury the three ball, right? And Wofford's top four scorers shoot better than 41% from three. Fletcher McGee's a 6'4 senior guard, averages 20 points. He had 7 threes in a recent game. This team could shoot the lights out. And I said 24-4. The four losses are to North Carolina, Oklahoma, Kansas, and Mississippi State. Ken Palm's got Wofford number 11 in offensive efficiency. Very dangerous team. I think another team coming on strong out of the Atlantic 10 is Virginia Commonwealth. And not a very good offensive team, but fourth in defensive efficiency, 22-6, 13-2, I think, yeah, 13-2 in the Atlantic 10, 9 straight wins. I love the way this team defends. And it's the Rams are hot right now going into March. If you watch this team, I think you got to be impressed with VCU. You know, it's not the shock of smart type of team necessarily, but still a dangerous team. So I like Washington, Wofford. VCU is kind of under the radar teams a little bit. And, you know, if you look at the top five in the nation in defensive efficiency, that's what I like to look at because coaching is a big part of my handicapping in college hoops. And I love Texas Tech because I think Chris Beard is a phenomenal coach.
He really is.
The top five team, yeah, the top five in defensive efficiency, I'll just give you a top four, are Texas Tech, Virginia, Michigan, and VCU. And three of my favorite coaches for a long time, well, Beard the past few years, Tony Bennett and John Beilein, you know. And that's, I think you have to look at teams that can defend and get stops. And those are teams that I think obviously have a chance to do something. Texas Tech, I've been really impressed because Chris Beard took that team to the Elite Eight last year, Doug, and they lost a lot. And I don't think many people expected the Red Raiders to be this good again. And that just shows you how good Beard is, and he's only getting better. I mean, they just put that 29-point massacre on Kansas. That was no fluke. I think Tech could be a Sweet 16 team, or who knows, maybe even a little bit better. Once again, that's an improving team. I do have a concern with Michigan. When you're talking about buy and sell, and I've noticed this over the past 6 weeks or so, John Beilein's just getting nothing from his bench. Michigan had 6 points from reserves in that loss to Michigan State over the weekend. Beilein's got nowhere he can turn with his reserves, and I think that's going to be a big concern for Michigan. I was really high on this team, but I've actually started to sell on Michigan a little bit here. So if you ask me buy and sell on a team that's highly touted with a coach I love and John Beilein, I think I might have to start to sell this team a little bit because the 3-point shooting is erratic. Like I said, there's no bench scoring, and I kind of feel like Michigan peaked a little bit too soon. So that's one team I'm
I think Michigan State did a great job against them by switching everything because so much of Michigan's offense is, you know, slip screens, back cuts, and a lot of stuff where you get exposed if you try to fight through picks. And Michigan State just went underneath everything and switched and challenged the Wolverines to shoot. And they don't have Mo Wagner, and they don't have the shooting. And if they're a little cold, then they look as badly as they did on Sunday for stretches of the game, especially when they lack poise, too. I mean, there was a lot of chuck and ducks, and I was really, really disappointed with how Michigan, because I'm a big fan of Beilein as well.
Yeah, I was disappointed in that game, and I actually lost a little money in that game, so I was not happy about that. But Michigan was a team I was really high on coming into the season, and I do feel like they peaked a little bit too soon. And Tom Izzo, we got to give a tip of the cap to that guy, because he comes in without Josh Langford, without Nick Ward, and stops Michigan's 22-game home win streak and did a phenomenal job, like you said, defensively. I just thought Spartans took away everything, almost everything, that the Wolverines were trying to do offensively. I'll tell you another team I'm going to sell here, and this is another coach I like a lot, but it's Eric Musselman in Nevada, and I wouldn't be surprised to see Nevada as a first-round upset victim in the tournament. Last year, we saw the Wolfpack make two remarkable comebacks to reach the Sweet 16, and this team, in my mind, has really played with fire the past year with really slow starts in most games. No true point guard. You got Caleb Martin running the point, and he's kind of like a battering ram. He just drives into the lane, out of control, into the defense, fires the ball up or loses the ball and draws fouls. He's not a true point, and they don't have very good three-point shooting, very inconsistent three-point shooting. And I think Nevada's a team that, it's been in the top 10 most of the season. It's been hyped, and I see a lot of holes in the Nevada Wolfpack. And we'll talk a little bit later about a big game coming up for that team this weekend. But I think two teams that a lot of us were high on early in the season, Michigan and Nevada, are teams I've really cooled on here in the past few weeks.
Yeah, it's funny. Nevada was the darlings of so many people entering the season because they do have that firepower. And, those first half deficits obviously bit them when they finally eventually lost at the Pit and were unable to come back in the second half. And side note, they're laying 17 at home to rival UNLV. Do you have a opinion on that game tonight?
Well, if I played that, I would probably just split a unit and play. The road team has covered 5 in a row in that series. I think I would split a unit, play UNLV first half and game, because like I said, Nevada's been such a slow starting team. The one problem with playing some of these dogs in college hoops is you could have a winner at halftime and then just get run off the floor in the second half, or the underdog loses contact in the final 5-8 minutes of the game, which I could easily see happening in Reno tonight, because UNLV is just a poorly coached team. Undisciplined on the offensive end, a lot of dumb shots, sloppy play and turnovers. So I'm not going to recommend anybody to bet their hard-earned money on the Rebels coached by Marvin Menzies. I took UNLV plus 1.5 against San Diego State on Saturday night.
And easy win.
Stealing.
Easy win.
Oh, yeah. stealing. Losing that game by 1 point. But it was – you had to see the end of it to believe it. But I would say if you played it, consider a first half play on UNLV, because Nevada does have a ridiculous history here in the past two seasons of slow starts in the first half, but then they turn it on in the second half and just run teams off the floor a lot of times. I just don't think UNLV is a team you want to go out on a limb with, let's put it that way.
Any other teams you're selling before we get into specific plays for tonight?
Other teams I would sell, I don't think Kansas State's going to do much in March, and I was not really surprised, not too surprised to see K-State go flat in Allen Fieldhouse on Monday night. That's just, that's a house of horrors for K-State, and they haven't, won there much at all over the past 40 years. So that was not that big a surprise to me that K-State faded a little bit. I'm selling most of the Big Ten, to be honest. We've talked all year about how this is the best conference, deepest conference in the country, and to a certain extent, I think that's true, but I don't see any elite teams in the Big Ten that I really fear going into March, let's put it that way, especially since Michigan State has so many injuries at this point. We don't know if Nick Ward's going to be back. I don't think the Big Ten's going to have a very good NCAA tournament. I'm not crazy about any of these teams, so I would say at this point, that's where I would stop on the fade list, because I don't have any other major teams I'm fading. I think some people might be fading Duke, let's face it. But I still think, you know, if Zion comes back, and I expect he will come back by March 9th for that game at North Carolina, I could still see, obviously, Duke making a huge run in the tournament, because that's a team that's going to get a favorable draw, as always. It's just a totally different team when you get Zion on the floor. You know, last night, I'm sure a lot of people laid the points with the Blue Devils on the road and thought, well, they'll figure it out. They got so much talent. Doug, think about this for a second. You know, the media loves to heap praise on Coach K. When was the last time Coach K won a game where he had less talent than the opposing coach?
Well, I think it would go back to the Dean Smith days, right? Like when he was going up against those teams with Anton Jameson, right. Rasheed, Vince Carter, because he kind of made the pivot and started getting the NBA players. Because prior to Elton Brand, he really didn't have good NBA players. I mean, he had the Grant Hill one-off, and you know, who knows what would have happened with Hurley. But really, those were guys that maximized their talent. That's why I thought he was such a better coach than Dean Smith. And then he started getting the recruits, the one-and-dones, and the before that, the exceptional talent like Jay Will. And the exceptional NBA talent. So Elton Brand, Battier, Jay Will, and then the next tier like Kyrie Irving, although Irving was banged up, and then some of these other guys with Okafor and Bagley and then now Zion Williamson and company. So he kind of changed and started getting the big-time talent, but before he was just out coaching with, and these guys are college football basketball legends, but it said something if they don't do that great in the NBA.
Yeah, it's interesting with Coach K, because I think he used USA Basketball, obviously, where, you know, the U.S. team's a 40-point favorite in every game. He used that to recruit all these one-and-done players for Duke, and I don't think it's worked out all that well. But he just does not win games unless he's got much better talent than the opposing coach, and he's very seldom been in that situation. You look at this Duke team, you take Zion off the floor, and all of a sudden Duke looks like a pretty mediocre team. It's especially offensively. Last night, Duke was 7-for-21 from three. This is a really poor three-point shooting team.
That's the thing that sticks out to me. I even tweeted it last night. I can't remember the last time. It's shocking to me that Duke, of all teams, doesn't have any snipers, right? Like, R.J. Barrett's Reddish and Barrett can shoot, but like their point guard can't hit the broadside of a barn. Like it's mind-boggling that they don't have those guys, whether it be J.J. Redick snipers or just guys who can hit open threes. And it is very surprising, because even guys like Bagley could, and they don't have that luxury, and that's their biggest Achilles heel, and it's heightened when they don't have Zion.
Yeah, none of those top four scorers for Duke, I'm pretty sure, I'm going to double-check the stats right now, but I think none of those guys shoot better than 35% from three. And, you know, I just talked about Wofford. He's got four top four scorers shoot better than 41% from three. Duke just doesn't have the shooting. Now, if you played Virginia on that day against Duke, you had to be a little bit sick, because right. The Duke freshman came out and looked like Craig Hodges and Larry Bird in one of those old-school NBA three-point shooting contests. They couldn't miss. You know, but that's an aberration and not the true Duke team. They're going to get hot, but here's the thing. Can they sustain it over six straight games in the tournament without consistent three-point shooting? I think there's no chance they sustain it unless Zion's back and fully healthy, and I think he is going to be back on March 9th.
Well, you're right. So the top four scorers, the best shooting percentage is 33.6. That's courtesy of Cam Reddish. And they do have O'Connell, but you're right. Like, these other teams have to. Like, even last night, Virginia Tech can just bring in a guy like Outlaw who just bombs threes. Like, you don't have that. And Coach K has done some impressive things. I think a couple years ago, remember, defense was their biggest issue. I think it was at Louisville. They had lost back-to-back games, and they went zone. And they had a nice win and turned their season around. They ended up winning it all that year. And that was the turning point. By going zone, and then they, you know, questionably beat Wisconsin in the championship game when Whiskey knocked off the undefeated Kentucky squad. So I think he's an excellent coach, but I just think he's missing something so important, and that's 3-point shooting. And obviously, it was a flat spot off the big win against Syracuse on the road last night. I just wonder how much confidence this team has, especially when Jack White can't make a shot either.
Yeah, it's definitely a team that's seriously flawed without Zion on the floor. I do want to say that hopefully he does come back March 9th or even before then, because I love watching the kid play. Even, you know, some people speculate, how's his game translate to the NBA? I don't really care about that right now. I think it's going to translate fine. He's going to be a damn good NBA player. I just love watching him play college hoops. Here's the thing. The guy is the most talented player on the floor, and he's the hardest player, at least in terms of effort. You never see his effort lacking, and that's the type of guy I think you hate to see get injured and hope he can make it back, because I really think he's a genuine kid who plays his ass off all the time, and hopefully he can make it back on the floor in March. You know, so many people talk about maximizing what you're going to make in the NBA, and I agree with what Charles Barkley said last week. You know, when has it become all about money? You know, playing in March Madness and being a part of trying to win a national championship is a great experience too. And that's why I think if he wants to play and come back, he should play and come back. And hopefully he does, you know, within 2 weeks here.
It is an interesting conversation, and I see obviously both sides. I mean, you can certainly understand it all, but hopefully, like, I echo your sentiment. Any games tonight? Let's talk about some games on the card tonight.
You know, I'm going to start with this Marquette-Villanova game, because Nova's really been struggling, obviously. We don't see this too often from a Jay Wright team. They have dropped 4 of 5, the Wildcats have. But here's the thing, and that streak started with a loss at Marquette on February 9th. That was a one-point loss. All these setbacks we're talking about from Villanova on the road. So back home tonight, against the one-man show, Marcus Howard. He has been a phenomenal playmaker this season. He had 38 points in that 66-65 win a few weeks ago for Marquette over Villanova. I think Marcus Howard is, without a doubt, first-team All-American, one of the top 5 players in college hoops this season, 25 points a game, almost 44% from three. I think Jay Wright's going to have a better defensive scheme this time around. It's always easier said than done when you're trying to stop a guy like Howard, but I think we'll have a better defensive game plan. And one of the weaknesses, obviously, for Villanova has been defense, 82nd in the nation in defensive efficiency. But I still believe in this team and the leaders, Phil Booth and Eric Paschal. Let's see, Marquette, I believe 12-1 in the past 13 games. Got a 1.5 game lead here in the Big East. To me, this is kind of like the K-State Kansas game on Monday, where a lot of people really down on Kansas going into that game, but they own the Big 12. A little brother comes in and they show him who's boss. I kind of think we're going to see the same situation here with Villanova Marquette. And, you know, it's kind of a must-win spot for Villanova, struggling here, like I said, dropping 4 of 5 back home. The one problem with this bet, Doug, is that last night when I looked at it, you could lay 3.5, and right now you pretty much have to lay 5.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's no bargain. I hate to give out a play at a bad number like this, but I do think Villanova is the right side tonight.
Well, it's not necessarily a bad number. It's just not as good of a number.
Well, however you want to phrase it, that's fine. But, I mean, it's if you could have laid 3.5, it's tough to lay 5. You know what I mean? So.
That's fair. What do you make?
I'll get to.
Okay, I'll let you go. I'm going to ask you about a couple a play I have, but yeah, go ahead.
Okay, I'm going to give you one more in the Big Ten, and it's going to be Illinois, and this is going to be a play. I also split half unit first half and half unit on the game, because Purdue has kind of been a slow starting team as well, but stretches margins out in the second half, especially at home. So you got to be a little bit careful with this one. I think you can play Illinois +7.5 in the first half and +13.5, maybe 14. You might be able to get a 14 for the game. And one thing about this Purdue team has failed to cover 4 in a row. And I think the biggest reason for that is Carson Edwards, who has been in a frigid shooting slump. He was, you know, early in the season, it was Carson Edwards and Purdue supporting cast. Who's going to step up, you know? A lot of people thought Carson Edwards and the Clowns. Well, now the Clowns are carrying Carson Edwards. Purdue's got a really strong supporting cast. A lot of these guys have stepped up and matured this season. Grady Eifert, one of the guys who's really stepped up. Trevion Williams, you know, a freshman in the low post. Edwards is still scoring 23.4 a game, but here's the deal. If you've watched him in the past three or four games, he's gone cold, but he's shooting more and more, kind of like chasing his losses, kind of like a bad gambler. He's 21 for 78 from the field, 7 for 39 from three in the past four games. In the past two games, 1 for 20 from three. And if Edwards is not busting out of his shooting slump tonight, Illinois is going to cover this number, 13.5. The Illini have actually lost by 14 points more only once in 2019. They've won four of the past six, and I think Brad Underwood has really got this team playing well. I know the Illini lost at home to Penn State over the weekend, but I watched that game. I just thought Penn State played really, really well. This Illini team has played well on the road. You know, actually kind of took Wisconsin to the wire in Madison last week. So I think catching this many points against the Purdue team that's not playing its best right now is a pretty good dog play in the Big Ten tonight.
That's an ugly dog. I have another one for you, and I can't decide if it's first half. Okay. I might have to split it, but Georgia Tech. This Virginia team's been playing with fire. Georgia Tech's actually been good on the road in conference play, and I think it's more so that the opponent is just looking past them and just trying to go through the motions. But you're catching 18 in what should be a low-scoring game, right, a low total, 122-ish. Catching that many points, and I think that's a lot for against a Virginia team that should just go through the motions.
Yeah, I'm not going to argue with that because I looked at this last night and I said, wow, you're catching 18.5 points. Actually, I think the number might have did the number
18.5
is
good. 18.5 is good.
Yeah, it opened. So this opened 20.5, and the total was 118.5. Very seldom are you going to get a 20-point underdog in a total with a game with a total of 118. I saw William Hill actually open this at 21. So, yeah, I don't disagree with that play. It also does look like a look-ahead spot for Virginia, right? So right. I agree with your analysis on that one.
So that's the one that jumped out to me for the card. And, I mean, look-ahead spots are really important because especially we have rivalry games coming up in the next week or so. So you talked about the rematch with Carolina. You're going to probably want to fade Duke and Carolina the game before, things like that. And this is really like the dog days of the season. I ran into Seth Greenberg in the lunch area, in the cafeteria the other day, and I asked him about it because, you know, it was that Virginia Tech-Virginia game where Virginia had no business winning, let alone covering. And then Virginia found themselves down 10 at Louisville at the break, and it's just sort of that dog day where you're just like tired. The new season excitement, so the regular season, or excuse me, the non-conference, then the early start to the conference season. And then you have that like 2.5 week window, maybe 2 week window where it's just like, but you may kind of make the turn. And I think next weekend you start saying, all right, we got the final week, senior night, that kind of stuff, conference championship week, and then March Madness. So you kind of get a newfound bounce in your step, a shot in the arm. So this is like the end of this like 2 week period where teams are just kind of sick of each other. You hear about it in the NBA where the All-Star break is so important because the locker room, all locker rooms can be just sort of like fractured or just full of annoyance, that I think it's a good spot to take some of these ugly dogs because things have been going so well for some of these teams that are winning a lot.
Yeah, I agree with that as well. You know, you heard Coach K say last night he thought his team, the quote he said was worn out. He thinks his team's worn out. And I think at this point, a lot of teams are mentally, players, you know, a little mentally worn down. Another aspect of that, and we've seen a lot of low-scoring, ugly games in some of these conference games recently. You know, you got your opponents scouted so well. You know exactly what they want to do, and you can take away their strengths. And I think a lot of times you're seeing teams struggle on the offensive end of the floor because there are no secrets at this point, right? You know, in conference play, you know every opponent's strength and weakness. So I think that's part of it as well. But you're right. It's a grind at this point. I think you see certain teams start to fade a little bit. And there is definitely some merit to handicapping that way, no question. You know, last night you kind of saw with Kentucky, right, that the Wildcats have been rolling for weeks here, and they've really looked good. And we're lucky. Let's face it, really lucky by Arkansas at Rupp Arena last night. And I think that was just a team that was Kentucky team that was had lost focus, probably looking ahead to Tennessee on the weekend, and didn't take Arkansas too seriously. So you're going to have spots like that, no doubt.
Well, let's talk about and wrap up with some spots coming up this weekend. While the teams look ahead, we will as well in a very excited frame of mind, because in these revenge spots really end up paying sweet dividends.
Hey, before we get to that quickly, you were talking about locker rooms and a little bit of fractured in the NBA. Could you imagine any locker room that's more fractured than the Lakers right now? I mean, that's
maybe the Celtics.
Yeah, well, Celtics too. Celtics got some problems. But if you think about the Lakers and you go to LeBron, and he sat out a month. He tried to get the coach fired. He tried to trade every teammate, and now he's trying to lecture his teammates every night when the Lakers lose. You know, when they lose, it's everybody else to blame. When they win, credit LeBron. I gotta think there's some major issues in that locker room right now. You and I had this debate or discussion, however you want to put it, on the air last week, and there's been a lot of debate about this in Vegas. Will the Lakers make the playoffs? And I've heard very strong opinions on both sides, and obviously now things are shifting to no. Do you still believe the playoffs are going to go on without LeBron?
Well, what I also mentioned, and I slipped it into that discussion on your show, was let's not sleep on the Spurs either. We're assuming that they can only catch the Kings. Spurs are now in the eighth seed. The only game they've looked good in the last, 10 is the first game after the All-Star break when those old guys were sort of fresh. But they've looked horrible in the two games since, including losing at the Garden against the Knicks. So yeah. I'm not putting past this second half of the season, this Spurs squad missing the playoffs. It'd be fascinating if both do and then the Clippers get in as well. But and then the T-Wolves maybe in the mix, but it'd be crazy to see both the Spurs and LeBron both miss the playoffs the same year after seeing them so long. So I the answer to your question is I don't know. I don't have a damn clue anymore. The right. Odds are what, plus 275 or whatever it is? But I still say yes, but I thought the win at Memphis had to come. But I think they'll get right. They should win tonight against New Orleans, obviously. And but they should have won in Memphis as well. So I have no opinion there, but I think it's interesting that the Spurs are now part of the equation.
Well, the Spurs are playing no defense whatsoever. And when they go 1-7 on the rodeo road trip, they look like a team that has no interest in
and 1-7 against the number, too.
Yeah,
but it's crazy that our BPI says the Lakers have a 3% chance to make the playoffs. The Doug PI, the Doug Power Index, has that higher than 3%.
Yeah, I do too. We talked about that the other day. I think with LeBron, you got to bump that number up, right? Duke had what, 90, or Louisville had a 99.5% chance to beat Duke with a 23-point lead and lost the game. So, you know, when you have that much talent, I think you have to factor that into the percent chance to win a game or reach the playoffs. I still think with LeBron, it's going to be more than 5% or 3%. But that locker room's going to be a mess. All right, so looking at this weekend, I think Tennessee's in a good spot here to get revenge against Kentucky. And you go back to that 118-84 beating Kentucky took in the season opener. You got to erase that line. Kentucky 24-3 with the three losses by a combined 5 points since then. Pretty damn impressive.
So by two to LSU, by two to at Alabama, and by one in overtime to Seton Hall.
Yep, that's it.
Crazy.
But this week, the Cats go to Knoxville, and they go without injured senior forward Reed Travis, who I love this addition. When Calipari got him to come over from Stanford as a grad transfer, I thought this was a phenomenal move for Kentucky. Travis has not put up huge numbers, but I think he's really valuable to this team in terms of he's got a strong defensive presence in the low post. And this is a type of matchup where I think Tennessee can exploit that with Grant Williams, you know, Admiral Schofield, the strength that the Vols have around the basket. I think they could probably take advantage of Kentucky without Reed Travis here. It was an obvious runaway when these teams met in Lexington 2 weeks ago, 17-point win. But, you know, you see a lot of cases in college hoops where a team gets blown out on the road and comes home and blows out the same opponent. I'm not saying this is going to be a blowout, but I like Tennessee. I think you're going to see big games from Williams and Schofield on Saturday with no Reed Travis on the floor. I like Tennessee over Kentucky.
What's the highest number you will lay? Like, what are you projecting the line will be, and you'll go up to what?
You know, I don't think it's going to be much. I think Tennessee is going to be a 3-point favorite or less. And nice. I have not looked at the Ken Palm projection on this yet. Basically, if you want to know what the number is, Doug, it's crazy. The college basketball market now, you go to the Ken Palm projections, and the lines are basically right on the numbers. You know, Tennessee and Kentucky, both top 10 teams in the Ken Palm. I think you probably lay 2 points with Tennessee, maybe three, something like that. Without Reed Travis, though, I think the matchups really favor the Vols here, and that's why I like him. You know, if Reed Travis were playing, I'd probably think about this game a lot differently. But the fact that he's not on the floor, I think Tennessee is going to have a much easier time scoring around the basket.
And which column, which numbers do you use?
What's that?
In the Ken Palm.
Well, if you go to FanMatch.
FanMatch, okay.
On Ken Palm. And look at, just go through today's Ken Palm FanMatch scores. And look at the lines on each game today. It's almost right on the number. It's crazy. And it's been that way most of the season. So I don't bet according to what the Ken Palm projections are and things like that, but you do have, it's something you do have to pay attention to, you know, if you're playing college hoops every day, because it's crazy how the screen reflects is a reflection of the Ken Palm numbers. It's insane, and I really think this has changed a lot in the past couple of years.
It has changed. There's no doubt about that. So there's a spot that you like there in Knoxville. Any others?
I'm going to go one Saturday night, Logan, Utah. And this is on the radar of a lot of sharp bettors, I believe. And I'm going to go Utah State over Nevada. I just talked about slow starts. This might be another play you want to split up first half, end game, because Nevada is a slow starting team. And right now, slipped to number five, probably a number five seed in the tournament, even with a 25-2 record. But this is more of a must-win game for Utah State, a team that's on the bubble, a 22-6. You got to win this home game against Nevada. If the Aggies lose this game Saturday night, they probably have to win the Mountain West tournament to get in. It's sad, but true, because the Power Five conference teams are going to get the benefit of the doubt on Selection Sunday, and a team like Utah State's going to be outside looking in if the Aggies can't win a game like this on Saturday night. They shoot it much better from three than the Wolfpack. Sam Merrill, 20-point-per-game scorer, dead-eye shooter. It's a tough place to play. If you watched last night, the Aggies took apart San Diego State and Logan. I think they can put away the Wolfpack on Saturday night. Now, Nevada is bigger, more athletic at almost every spot. If you watched the first meeting, you would not want to make this bet, because when these teams met in Reno, it was a 23-point win for the Wolfpack, and it was not really that close. But I think it's going to be a much different game on Saturday. Nevada is going to be a short favorite, most likely. I'm going to say Nevada opens two. I'll take two with Utah State, the better shooting team at home that's desperate, that has to have this win. So Tennessee and Utah State would be the two games I like the most right now on Saturday.
All right, so circle Saturday for that as the calendar turns to March. My man, it was good catching up, and I know the audience and loyal listeners of the Behind the Bets podcast really appreciate the insight, because that's certainly what the feedback I get from them. So thanks for sharing the wisdom. It was good to catch up.
Hey, you bet. Anytime, man.
All right, take care. All right, that's Matt Humans of Vegas Stats and Information Network, also a longtime handicapper in Las Vegas. Coming up next, we'll keep it in the Valley and bring in Brett Okamoto to break down this weekend's UFC card.
Kicking is for losers.
It is when you're talking about football, but not mixed martial arts. And we welcome back to the Behind the Bets podcast. We now go out to Las Vegas and bring in UFC and MMA insider Brett Okamoto. Brett, how are you, man?
I'm doing well, man. Must be a big fight week if I'm talking to you, Doug.
Yeah. We got a lot of options here on the card. It is in Las Vegas, so no traveling for you, which is a good thing, I would imagine, because you travel a lot. What's crazy to me, and, you know, you and I go way back. We've talked about it on the podcast from my years of living in Las Vegas. But I was covering the UFC in 2001 when I worked in Iowa, and we covered locally the Miletich fighting camp. And a lot of fighters were out there, and it was dudes like Jens Pulver, Matt Hughes, Tim Sylvia, and also Robbie Lawler, who is still fighting in the UFC here in 2019, and he's on the poster, so one of the main events, if you will. But what's going on there? How is Robbie Lawler still fighting?
Man, I don't know. I don't have a great answer for you on that. I mean, you know, he started very young.
Right, so he's only 36.
Very young. So you know, if you start that young, you have success that young, then it makes it feel like, you know, you've been around longer just because, you know, people are paying attention to you the whole time. But, yeah, I mean, Rob is what's interesting about Rob, too, is that he's been in his share of wars, man. It's not like he's a George St. Pierre guy that just has dominated competition and out-wrestled guys and never taken any damage. I mean, he goes out there and it's fan favorite because he gets a slugfest. So pretty crazy. Rob is just a one-of-a-kind dude.
Former Bettendorf Bulldog. Give a little shout-out to the Quad Cities and my former stomping grounds. Let's talk about the guy at the top of the card, John Jones, minus $11 at the time of this taping here at the Westgate. Obviously, his talent and skill set is really undeniable over the years, but he's had so many issues away from the octagon. He hasn't lost, technically, since 2009, and that's why he's such a big favorite. How do you handicap this fight?
I mean, about where it's at. You know, it's one of those fights where the more you study it, the more you can't find a way that Anthony Smith is going to win. And I don't say that to disrespect Anthony. I just, you know, Anthony is a former middleweight, and he was fighting 185 pounds just a year ago. I mean, he lost at middleweight 1 year ago in February of 2018. So he's had a meteoric rise through the 205-pound division, and part of that is due to his talent and due to his ability to finish fights, but part of it is also just that division is pretty empty. I mean, if you can knock out a couple people, then you can make a real, real big climb up the ranks, which is exactly what Anthony Smith has done. I mean, he's not a particularly big guy for 205 pounds. He's not a particularly athletic guy. I mean, certainly when you compare him to John Jones, I mean, he's facing just about every disadvantage possible in this fight. Technically, athletically, the only advantage that he does have on John Jones is the experience. And I do think that is worth something. I think that when you're talking about an underdog of that size, you know, Anthony Smith is just one of those guys. This is going to be his 45th professional fight. So he's just comfortable everywhere. He knows what it feels like to be on, you know, he knows what it feels like to be the hammer, and he knows what it feels like to be the nail. And if he's in the nail in there against John Jones, he still has a little bit of a chance because he's not going to fold. It's not going to be something that he's never felt before. He's still going to be a little bit dangerous in there, but technically speaking, he just doesn't have a whole lot of ways of winning this fight.
Made his light heavyweight debut in 2018, so a year ago in June against Rashad Evans, and won that in the first round. So he's 3-0 since, including that fight. So 2018 went 3-0, but actually I should say 3-1. He lost the fight before that, but it is hard to. I mean, so this is a sport where you do see upsets, right? That's why it's different than so many other sports, like. I'll never forget George St. Pierre losing to Matt Serra. Now, obviously, GSP had some personal issues that week going on, so there's some justification, but it was a similar line, minus $11 or so, and you can see it because there is a road to recovery from losing that these fighters sort of understand, and that's why they maybe, I don't know, are like open to losing, but it's just not, it's not like boxing Floyd Mayweather's path, so to speak. But I also do not see it, Brett.
Yeah, I mean, if you're trying to predict a massive upset, you know, I think like in this sport, you're looking for certain things. I mean, you're looking for like motivation. You know, I mean, is John Jones properly motivated for this fight, or is he overlooking it? You know, that could be a dangerous thing for a favorite. Or you look at is there one particular hole where that everyone is so enamored by how great this one person is that they're completely overlooking what they're bad at. And that's what happened, you know, with the Ronda Rousey, Holly Holm situation. You know, we were so enamored by the armbar and so enamored by Ronda's ability to just walk forward that we kind of ignored the fact that she was getting pieced up every time she walked forward. It just never had any effect on her, you know, so we didn't care. But then when we saw Holly Holm have some success with it and actually be able to hurt her when she was walking forward, well, then we realized, wow, Ronda Rousey has a serious problem that we just kind of didn't talk about, you know. John Jones doesn't have that. That situation does not apply to John Jones. Like I said, there's nothing that Anthony Smith does that is, and again, you know, hindsight is always 20/20, but I'm looking at every single aspect of John Jones, and I just don't see where Anthony has the advantage. I don't see where he has the ability to put the fight where he needs it to be, where he has the ability to control the fight. I think the best thing that he can probably do is probably just try to make this look like a street fight. because just technically he's not going to beat Jon Jones. And Jon Jones just has so many different ways to beat Anthony Smith. Like, if you look at it from the other direction, he's got infinite ways to beat Anthony Smith. So, and again, I feel bad saying all this because I think Anthony Smith is a talented fighter, and I think he's got a lot of heart. And if you read his story and you're aware of his past, I mean, this guy has no quit in him. But no quit is not going to get it done against Jon Jones. And the other thing I mentioned about the motivation, I think Jon Jones is motivated. He looks like he's in great shape. He's had all that time off. He wants to fight four times this year. I think because he wants to rebuild his legacy after everything that happened over the last few years. And I think he wants to get paid. I think he wants to fight four times so that he's always relevant. He's always in front of people. He's always knocking people out. And he's going to get those big money fights that he feels like he missed over the last few years. So I think Jon Jones is firing on all cylinders right now. And Anthony Smith is not catching him at a good time.
Let's talk about the other co-main event, Tyrone Woodley against a guy who's received a lot of sharp action, Kamaru Usman, who is the underdog here, but that line's come down. At last check, Woodley's a $1.80 favorite, the comeback plus 150. What's your analysis of this?
Yeah, I think it's an interesting fight for Woodley as the champion, just because so far in his title reign, he's fought opponents that have a very, very specific skill set and a very specific way that if they were going to win the fight, it was going to be in this way. You know, when he fought Wonderboy Thompson, that was, I don't want to call him a one-trick pony, but we knew exactly how he was going to beat Tyron if he did. You know, he was going to beat him on the feet, and he was going to be elusive, and he was going to draw him into a big shot and potentially hit him with a spinning wheel kick or something of that nature. You know, he's just a flashy counter-striker. And then when he fought Damian Maya, Maya was, you know, a submission specialist, one of the best submission specialists in the world, certainly in the UFC. You know, on the ground, could he figure out a way to drag Tyron Woodley down to the ground and submit him? It didn't happen. You know, and then he fought Darren Till is a young guy, but he's huge for the division. I mean, just a massive, massive guy. He comes in with a lot of confidence. He has a huge left hand. Tyron Woodley hurt him very quickly in their fight at UFC 228 and finished that fight. So this fight, though, Kamaru Usman is just well-rounded. There's not one particular way in which he has to beat Tyron Woodley. He has a full skill set, you know. I still would make Tyron Woodley the favorite in this, just because I think they have somewhat similar skill sets, and Tyron Woodley has proved it a little bit more, and he's proven it against tougher competition, in my opinion. But he is older, and you know, I just brought it up with Jon Jones. Hunger is a real thing.
Sure.
And Tyron Woodley has never had a problem being motivated. He's always impressed me in that way. But this is now, you know, I think his fifth title defense. He's had the belt for a number of years. He's got other avenues. He's got other platforms. He's releasing, you know, rap music. He's really getting into the entertainment world. He's bouncing around between California and Milwaukee. And a lack of hunger can kind of sneak up on you, even if you don't know it. And I'm not saying that the Tyron Woodley is coming into this unmotivated, but I know the Kamaru Usman's coming in motivated. That's never a question for me with Usman because he's never had it before. So Could this be the fight in which a little bit of that catches up with Tyron Woodley and he runs into a really hungry guy? It could be, and maybe that explains the line movement.
We've mentioned the Robbie Lawler fight. Look, we can break down every fight. I won't do that here, but there's a couple underdogs you like. You think there's some value there. Let's talk about those, and I'll let you take it away to why you like a couple dogs that stick out to you.
Yeah, well, the Lawler-Aspen fight's pretty intriguing for me. I mean, if you follow the sport, you know, Ben Askren is probably the best fighter in the world who has not fought in the UFC yet. He got in feuds with Dana White. Those two went back and forth. They could never come to a deal. He was a former champion of Bellator. He was a champion out in Japan and out in, well, Asia, I should say. And now he's finally getting an opportunity to come into the UFC. He was actually traded for Demetrius Johnson in a deal that I never thought I would see. He's facing Robbie Lawler, who has not fought. He didn't fight last year because of a torn ACL. He's, as you mentioned right off the bat, you know, he's been a guy who's been around for a long time. But Askren hasn't fought for a while either. He kind of announced he was done in 2017. So neither one of these guys had fought last year. The only reason I would love to take Lawler. I would love to take a former champion plus the money.
Yeah, plus 225.
Askren is a guy who went to the Olympics as a wrestler, and if you follow this sport, you just don't bet against guys who went to the Olympics as a wrestler. You don't bet against the Daniel Cormiers of the world. You don't bet against Henry Cejudo. You don't bet against Yoel Romero. All those guys, they're just like made. They're cut from a different cloth. their competitive spirit is just so phenomenal, and they just know how to win. Like, if you make it to the Olympics in any capacity, you are a just proven winner, and I don't want to put my money against you. Maybe that's a square thing to say, that I just don't want to do it, but it just tends not to work out for you. Ben Askren has never lost, so as much as I would love to take Lawler on the plus, I won't touch it.
Hold on. It's actually not a square thing. I'm going to interrupt you. It's not a square thing to say. Look, getting talked off a bet is just as effective as getting talked onto a winning bet, right? Getting talked off a losing bet is just as effective as getting talked on to a winning bet, because it's all about aggregating information, and people listening to this podcast and everywhere else just want to hear people's input. You can't follow ever anyone blindly. So that comment, I think, is fair. I think it's totally fair if you, if you really believe that. And it's something to be said, especially when there's such a, you know, we talked about it last time with the Greg Hardy, right? How he was a big favorite, but he has never been on this stage in this moment. Yeah, playing in the NFL is a different kind of big stage. But there's something to be said about these guys who are former champs, and like you said, former Olympians as well, that there is a component to the pressure and the island feel of being in that octagon, and you're the only person impacting this. It's not a team sport. They have team members in the corner, but this is, you're there alone on an island. So I think it's effective and certainly a worthy topic to discuss.
Yeah. I mean, the only reason I said it, I suggested it may be squares, because I don't think you should just completely handcuff yourself to a rule of saying, I'll never bet this situation, I'll never bet that situation. You should probably look at it independently. I guess that's kind of like just my take on it. But I just have come to learn, you know, I mean, Daniel Cormier, the only guy he's ever lost to is Jon Jones, who's probably the greatest fighter of all time. Ben Askren has never lost to anybody. You know, Yoel Romero, the only guy he's ever lost to was Robert Whittaker, who is the current middleweight champion. He's probably arguably one of the top 5 pound-for-pound guys in the world. So I think you get sucked into the value and look at the glitzy number and say, you know, hey, I could see how Robbie Lawler could win this fight, but those Olympic guys, man, I don't want to bet against them. It's just something that has been ingrained in me as I look over the sport. But the two ones that stand out to me on this card, and certainly neither one of them are a lock, but Pedro Munhoz is a bantamweight. He's fighting Cody Garbrandt. And Cody Garbrandt is a guy who had a really, really fast rise. He won a UFC title by beating Dominic Cruz in an absolutely spectacular performance. But then he ran into his former teammate, TJ Dillashaw, twice. And TJ knocked him out both times. And that was Cody's last two fights. And after he was knocked out the second time, you know, he kind of disappeared for a little bit. And, you know, he was still in the gym and you know, he was just quiet. He was doing his own thing. And I want to see Cody Garbrandt more this week. I want to try to get a read on his confidence. You know, I mean, when you go in and you lose two fights of that magnitude in that kind of way, and he took a lot of damage in those fights. I mean, he was knocked out bad in both of those fights. You know, getting a guy like Pedro Munhoz, who I think is very well-rounded, underrated at plus money, I think that's probably something worth taking a look at. And then the other one is Charles Byrd. He's fighting Edmund Shahbazyan. It's a fight that not a lot of people know a whole lot of either guy. If they know either guy, it's Edmund. He's a pretty talented prospect. He's a guy who's had a lot of first-round knockouts in his career. In fact, every fight that he's had except one, so he's 8-0, seven of his fights have ended in the first round via knockout. The one fight that didn't go that didn't end in the first round, it went three rounds and it was a split decision. I think this guy, he's only 21 years old. He still has a lot to prove. I could be very wrong on this. Edmund, he's got a lot of talent. He's got a lot of knockout power, obviously. He's been finishing guys in the first round. But all those guys that he finished, all seven of those guys that he finished, they weren't great. They didn't have a great record. Collectively, they had a record of 28-46. So now he's fighting a guy who's 35 in Charles Byrd, who has a lot more experience than him. If I can get plus money on that situation with an unproven talent in Edmund Shahbazyan, I'll probably take Byrd.
All right, so going against my Armenian brethren, huh?
Unfortunately, on this case, on this one, I got to do it.
SoCal will be rooting against you. But no, look, there. In just in all this, it's tough to find value. We talked about it in the last podcast, in that the market is tighter. It's not like 10 years ago, right? There's more information out there. The betting is smarter now, and the odds makers are more in tune. So it's tough to find value, so you can get plus money on a sport where we talked about earlier that there are upsets is certainly applicable.
Yeah, I mean, it's just a tough sport to bet on, quite frankly, because it's so unpredictable. I mean, you may have some.
Isn't every sport, though? I mean, come on.
It is, but man, you don't see other sports turning on literally one punch and half of an inch. You know, where two guys throw a left hook at the exact same time, and one of them happens to land on the jaw, and the other one misses by a centimeter, and that's the fight. You know, maybe well,
okay,
I'm
but that's like okay, but that's why we have the point spread, right? So like the point spread does come down to one or two plays often, right? So the point spread is the great equalizer. And then the money line factors in the likelihood of that one punch or something like that. That's essentially, I mean, that's a very oversimplifying way to discuss it, but like that's essentially what we're talking about here.
True. Yeah. Just the momentum swings in fighting are just insane. You know, not that they can't be. I mean, you throw a pick six in a football game, of course, but I mean, it's just one guy. It's not a team, you know, as you mentioned earlier. It's not a collective, you know, set of like, well, maybe there's one guy who's, you know, going through some personal problems on a football team that we don't know about, but, you know, the other team will pick up the slack. Like, no, it's just one guy. And if that guy's having an off night or he's just not feeling it or something happens or he suffers a little minor injury, you know, they're locked up in a clinch and all of a sudden his shoulder gets popped. I mean, then you're just done, you know, like there's, it feels like this one has just so many variables and it can go wrong so quickly in MMA. And I think that that's what makes it fascinating to watch too.
Cool. Yeah. And it's obviously fascinating to bet on too. It's the entertainment component above anything, but like that is the, I'm trying to think of the fight. It was at the Palms Pearl. There was one guy who was just bloodied the entire fight in the last like 20 seconds, just came out of nowhere and won the fight. So you always get that as well.
Yep.
All right, my man. Well, thanks for joining us and offering the perspective. And enjoy the card this weekend. Should be a great atmosphere at T-Mobile. And we'll get you back here on the podcast as well soon.
That sounds great, man. Thanks.
All right, you got it, Brett.
Kicking is for losers.
That is always the case in football, but not in MMA. So thanks to Brett Okamoto and thanks to Matt Humans as well of Vegas Stats and Information Network for joining us here on the podcast. Troy. Long time, first time, I imagine. Any confessions of a non-gambler? It's what we like to wrap up the podcast with. Anything I mentioned, Matt or Brett mentioned, that was saying, huh, I don't get that.
Yeah, Doug, so as we said at the beginning of the podcast, I don't know the first thing about gambling. You mentioned a lot about fading and backing. I don't know what that means. Can you enlighten me?
Yeah, so backing is probably what you would assume it is. I'm going to back them, like I'm going to bet on them. Let's say I'm going to back... Matt says buying Washington, Wofford, VCU, Texas Tech the rest of the way. I'm going to back Texas Tech this weekend. I'm going to back Tennessee against Kentucky, meaning I'm going to bet on them. They are a bet on team.
So they're going to show support with your dollars.
There you go. And fade is the opposite. So it's funny that you mentioned that because I believe in the DFS space, the daily fantasy sports, fading means like passing. But in the betting space, for the most part, fading means betting against. So actively betting against, not just passing. So there's avoiding, there's passing, stay away. Those are terms that you would think is just, you know, no bet. But fading is like, so like he said he's going to fade Nevada down the stretch here, meaning bet against them. By doing that, you bet on whoever they're playing.
Okay.
So I'm going to fade Nevada in the next three games, meaning I'm going to bet on their opponent the next three games. So he's going to fade Nevada. In this case, he's going to bet on Utah State. And so, but it's more applicable because he liked, that was more, the philosophy was more bet on Utah State. So it wasn't like a fade to Nevada. Fading Nevada is like a general comment down that, like, I don't want any part of them and I'm going to look to bet against them in many spots. So I am fading Virginia tonight. So it's not like I love Georgia Tech. This is more of a bet against Virginia. So I'm fading Virginia right now in what's, you know, essentially like a flat spot coming off couple big wins against rival Virginia, and then Louisville coming back with a 10-point deficit at halftime.
Okay. I also got one more question for you.
Absolutely. Continue. This is a open space here. No judging. Just pure confessions of a non-gambler.
In one matchup, you also said you're going to split a unit.
Right.
I don't know what that means either.
Meaning first half and game, he said?
Yeah.
Matt's, okay, so what happens is a lot of gamblers, it's all based on like unit size. I am not like that. Usually like the math model guys are because they're very math driven and they want to be disciplined. But, you know, Matt is not a math model guy, but he's definitely disciplined. So let's say if your regular bet is $50 or let's say it's $100, you would do 50 on the first half, 50 on the game. So there are point spreads for everything. In the NBA, you can bet first quarter, first half, second half, game line, whatever. Most people, and we typically on this podcast and everywhere else, talk about the game line. But occasionally, based on your line of thinking, which is also called a handicap, your analysis can factor in the first half. Like New Mexico just, Nevada is just a very slow starting team. So he's going to split up his bets tonight with Illinois, gotcha. Purdue. Purdue also a slow starting team. He's going to put half his bet, what he normally bets on a game, he's going to put half of it on the first half and half of it on the game line, entering the bet. So you can always bet second half too in a different bet, but he's going to split it up. And sometimes that's a smart way of going about things. If you think your analysis is more pronounced in a first half bet. So like last Saturday and Sunday in the NBA, the Spurs lost at the Knicks. They were embarrassed. The Lakers lost at New Orleans, embarrassed. The Warriors lost at home to the Rockets. And then the Sixers were completely embarrassed at home, although to a good team in the Blazers. Well, Monday I said I would bet all four first quarter teams in sort of like bounce back spots. Conventionally, oh, let's bet them in the game line. Well, if your analysis for the game line is that you think they're going to start strong, why not do the whole bet about the start, right? If it's all about like coming back and focusing and starting strong, then make the bet more focused on the start, which would be in the NBA, a first quarter bet. And they went 2-2, those four first quarter bets. But sometimes you can bet first team to score 10 points, first team to score 20 points. You can do those kind of prop bets, which again speaks, if that's your analysis, I think it makes more sense to isolate that analysis in a bet, whereas it might be more diluted over the course of a full game.
Okay, that all makes perfect sense.
There you go.
For articulating that to me, I have no more confessions to make.
All right, good. Well, again, judge-free zone here. We're all inclusive here. All right, so thanks to everyone for listening in. Matt on Villanova -5 tonight. Also, Illinois plus the 13 and a hook. I'm on Georgia Tech plus 18 and a half. And then looking ahead to the weekend, Tennessee at home against Kentucky and Utah State also at home against Nevada. And Brett was looking at some value there with Bird and Munoz, and I was passing along some sharp play for Mr. Director Usman in the co-main event. Always good to have Murray on here. We'll get him back soon as well. Troy, thank you for filling in. You were wonderful as always.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
All right, my man. Thanks, everyone, for downloading. We'll have more podcasts and much more announcements coming up next week, so stay tuned on all our ESPN platforms.
Thanks for listening to Behind the Bets. You can listen and subscribe on the ESPN app or download and listen on Apple Podcasts.